delighted and honored that you're here, that we get to keep pursuing this mindset, this amazingly profound teaching that comes out of the lips of the first century Aramaic Yeshua on how to let loose of the mind of the past and step into the actual present, the actuality of what life is as human beings, what's possible, what we're capable of. That state that when a certain number of disciples were told what they needed to do, they said, who can understand that saying? Too hard a saying. And they left and didn't come back. We're looking to understand this word that we've spoken about several times, Rachma, which is a gateway filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that makes our human minds available for perception that comes from the actuality of what's going on in the world, rather than coming from or being a reflection of whatever stored in carbon-based memory that's resonated into activity by what's going on in the world. And where most people take what's stored in their carbon-based memory systems. Remember, we've talked about this idea that we store literally, energetically. I mean, they've proven they can take somebody and put them into a somnambulistic state of hypnosis, and they can take them back to the moment of their birth, and they can tell you who was in the room. They can tell you what mother's hairdo was. They can tell you the emotional state of everybody in the space. All of that information is recorded. It is all stored in carbon-based memory. What the ancient teachings refer to as Adam, Adamos, the red clay. So there's that mind, that perceptual construct that's always putting before us something that replicates its content and using that to cover up what would come in through what one might call the divine mind, or one might call come in from the actuality. And it's Rachma that prepares the space for the mind to be formed from actuality rather than from carbon-based memory. So we're talking about, you know, sort of competing minds. One of those minds, and this has nothing to do with religion, one of those minds is the mind of active present love. It was called the mind of Christ in you, not a religious idea. Christ in Aramaic being the name of an office, not a person's name. And so we either live in that mind, and that mind is fueled and powered by active present love, or we live in a mind that goes against that. So we have those two options. The mind that goes against the mind of love will take everything that love has to say, turn it around, and find a way to abuse you with it. Find a way to send you to hell. Find a way to tell you that love has got this horrid place for you, has all kinds of insanity, and the insanity that it holds is stored in this carbon-based memory system. If you took your carbon-based memory system, multi-generational database called your body-mind unit, into the chemist shop and had them do a breakdown of the elements of your carbon-based memory, they would tell you that your body-mind unit is made of carbon. And they would further tell you that carbon has a carbon, a natural carbon atom, has 6 electrons, 6 protons, and 6 neutrons. 666. Does that number mean anything to anybody? So we have the mind of love, or what was called the mind of Christ, and then the mind that goes against that, which is what? The Antichrist. It is this perceptual system that is relentless and always has something to say about everything. If you listen to this man Yeshua from 2,000 years ago, he said, I have a pathway through to the truth of your life. I have a pathway to your perfect life. In fact, he said, and he said, it's the words. Perception is run by words. The mind is run by words in the human realm. Broca's area is right next door to the emotional center. It's a place where words are processed, are right there with words, and that's why a specific word can trigger somebody into a fit of rage or what have you, activated from carbon-based memory. Who has heard the words that came out of Yeshua's mouth? Nobody in the West has. So, what we're looking to do as we're going through this dictionary, as we're going through the Enlightenment book, is we're looking to build the brain cells to actually be able to hear the words, those perfect words that are your perfect life, that is the instruction set, not something magical, not something mysterious, not something mystical, just simply what takes this carbon-based memory system into the point where it shuts up. Forgiveness is one of the keys to it. And you remember that Lenin, the man probably responsible for more deaths on planet Earth than any human being in history, said the way you destroy a culture is change the meaning of its words. So what we're looking to do is to return to brain cells so we can actually hear what was being said and facilitate carbon-based memory in letting go, in forgiving. There's a man named Rabula. His name is the root of our word today that we would call rabble-rouser. He was a priest. It seems like he understood what Lenin was saying about destroying the meaning of words, because he went on a rampage and destroyed all the Aramaic Bibles he could find and replaced them with his own translations, changing the meanings of Yeshua's words to those that he decided were correct. And you remember in those ancient teachings they said, every word will be accounted for. Every word represents an energy frequency, and we're looking to get to the point where we set this carbon-based memory system up so that it has in it the space for divine perception, to be sourced from the energetic pattern of the actuality in which we live, move, and have our being, rather than the relentless carbon-based memory system that always injects its drama, its trauma, its game, its hostilities, its fears, its prejudices, its terrors, and its traumas. The trick is getting that thing to let go and remembering that the core tool of Yeshua was that of forgiveness. What does forgiveness do? It gets carbon-based memory to let go, whatever its construct is. When forgiveness is activated, that construct of carbon-based memory collapses. You'll notice that the ego mind came back, and now we have a thing that's globally known called forgiveness, and it goes like this. I'm in pain, And it's really clear to me that it's all your fault. But it's okay. I'll forgive you. I'll let you off the hook. And we have people running around the world. I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. And look at the mess. Please, never, ever forgive anyone for anything. And to that, I often have people say, oh, that's right, I have to forgive myself. No, please, never, ever attempt to forgive yourself for anything. But forgive continuously. That is, apply the tool called forgiveness, which in the first century Aramaic language is how you collapse what's going on in carbon-based memory. It's how you get that mind, the mind of Adamos, the mind of man, as it was referred to in the ancient scriptures, and you get that sucker to shut up. And when you get it to shut up, as the Course in Miracles says, you now have a clean and open space within your mind for Christ to come. You now have a clean and open space where the still small voice, where the subtler energy of active present love will write the meanings in your mind, no matter what you're facing. And you can't beat that guidance system with a stick. But it is a process. One of the core facilitators of that process in us was called in Aramaic Ruach HaKodesh. It is the breath. So the activity of the breath becomes key in the process. Persian word paraklita. In Persian, is to break loose or to break away. Lita, the curse of, the effects of error, or doings that are unfit. So John 14:26 ends up becoming she who breaks off the effects of doings which are unfit in you. And then once you realize the Aramaic meaning of this word, then you realize that this word represents the power that has the ability, unless denied, to collapse, to undo carbon-based memory. And what's at the root of it, all of the effects of that. And yet so many people are committed to their drama and their trauma and their pain and their perceptions of blame, their commitment to the one world universal religion of blame. There's somebody whose fault this is, that that mind will not let go in them. And that is the denial of this power, that when we step in through willingness and acceptance, will undo all of the effects of our errors for all time. And then, on the other end of the equation, that's the power that will teach us the truth. So that's where we want to head. Overall, we're going to change, we're going to look at and shift back to change out of the carbon-based memories interpretation and get back to the truth. So that's what we're here to do. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of that conversation. And Ms. Jean, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
No, it is all quiet on this end.
Well, if I had my druthers, that's exactly where I'd be at this point. Quiet. Just in that space of silence. It's kind of hard to communicate when we're broadcasting like this out of silence. So we'll move forward. So we were on page 74 in the dictionary, running through some of the dictionary definitions of words to create a foundation for going through these passages that we're going to cover. And we're about halfway down the page at the word C-E-A-N, seen, as in Dadsin, pure, clean, sound, free of fault. And that's what we're looking to do. That's what the Beatitudes are talking about, in having a mind that is free of fault. A mind that is literally fueled by the active presence of love. Completely sound and purified mind. So that beatitude that's historically interpreted as, and people call it a translation, it really isn't a translation, but it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, in Aramaic. It's you who have a completely purified mind, you will comprehend the invisible source of creation. And as that space opens in you, it's like nobody wants anything else. Once that comes into action, so that word from the Aramaic Beatitude, Dadsin, Matthew 5:8, Beatitudes, where the constructs of your mind are free of fault, free of what carbon-based memory would give them. But there's nothing based in hostility or fear to defile the mind, to defile the verbal system. And when you've done that work, then what the Beatitude in Aramaic says is you will literally have an ability to comprehend the Creator directly. Pretty giant promise. And the key in that one again is Ruka Tikucha. She who breaks off the effects of doings which are unfit. What is unfit? Unfit for a human life is any form of hostility or fear. And they talk about, remembering that the word sin in Aramaic is an archery term, means off the mark. They talk about how God can't look on sin, and it becomes some sort of a mysterious, what does that even mean? But all that it means is, in your essence, where you are created of the active presence of love, there is no room for, there is no resonance with, there is no possibility of even conceiving of that energy. It's the mind that holds it and structures it over and over and over again. And when we fall out of awareness of who we are as created love, and we fall into identification with a false self that's based in defense, that's based in hostility and fear. Letting go is not an easy thing for that mind. And it is carried on the breath. So this prefix, diapostrophe, page 74, just beneath the definition of that word, C-E-A-N, pure, clean sound, free of fault, and it's a sikuja, that elemental force for that which is proper. So it's that which, it's the root of the word kosher, what's proper for humans. It's free of anything based in any form of hostility or fear. And that's ultimately what we need to do with our minds. Diapostrophe being a prefix that speaks of something that is. So the Matthew 12:32 datid is that which is to come. So ultimately, where do we end up? We end up in this space which is to come, which is the place where we are freed of, if we're willing to do the work involved. If we're willing to have the work done in us, if we're willing to set free that feminine elemental force in us, breaks off the effects of that which is unfit. And what is unfit? Just how many generations has this unfit energy? Just take a look at the world. Just turn on the television set, and you'll see what's unfit for humans virtually continuously. Can you get that unfit mind to let go for even a minute? If you do, everything in your life will be transformed. And then another prefix, DA or DAD, that it is complete. The entire thing has to go. So John 1:14, Damali, complete. Filled, complete truth, completeness beyond even belief. And then Degali, those who commit. So go back and look at this word, Degel, just down below. We're back to the Beatitudes, a mind structure or a set of mind underlying mendacious, lying, falsifying, treacherous, deceiving speech or action. If one is lost in that, if one is committed to that, it's the opposite of what the Beatitudes are inviting us to do. And when one becomes so ensconced in that, so captured in that state, it's almost as though the prompting of Rukha, there's no room for it to land, there's no place for it. There's no resonance left. In the same way that, you know, they talked about the Creator cannot look upon sin, those energies that are off the mark, and it isn't that, you know, eyeballs aren't going to look at it. It's that there's just no resonance. There's no place for that energy to land in it. And when one becomes so steeped in the hostility and fear game, it's like there's no place for the activation or the resonance of that which is exculpatory. Fortunately, when you understand the physics of it, there is this thing called resonance. You know, those who would say, well, someone who's stuck in that, well, they're just lost. That's it, they're lost. But when you understand the process of resonance, if someone is committed to being that space of active present love, because behind all of the shadows, no matter how deeply one has fallen into that, what's been called that lost state, because the essence of each of us remains the same, to stand as the space of conscious active love is to give possibility to those who appear to be lost. Remembering that we live, move, and have our being in this energy system called love, with free will and the ability to avoid the presence of love. And the one who's lost in that depth of hostility and fear tends to resonate the same in those around them and seem to be lost. But one who understands that resonance of that line from the worksheet, and I go back to this because it was insight for me. This is about 35 years ago. We started in a school in Delray Beach, Florida, kindergarten to grade 8. And this was so present for me at that point that the first lesson we went in for a full month, we picked a theme for the month, and there were 4 different teachers that I worked with in establishing that school or that program in the school, which is still running, called Lessons in Living. And the first lesson in that month that everybody went in to bring to these kids from kindergarten to grade 8 is, when I choose love, it wakes up the love in everyone. How powerfully committed am I to holding to that presence of love? And what is there in me based in hostility or fear that can break me away from that presence of love? That's what needs to be weakened. That's what needs to be repeatedly de-energized or forgiven. And that's where Yeshua said 77 times, 70 times forgiveness, to weaken the grip, the grasp of that non-being self. One of the keys to that is to make sure that you fully allow this feminine elemental force that breaks off the effects of errors into your life. And it is literally the breath. So if one is stuck in that mind structure, mendacious, lying, falsifying, treacherous, deceiving speech or action, and then if we take a look at the suffix OOTH, O-O-T-H, let's go back and take a look at that. If you slide back in the dictionary too. Page 90, up toward the top. Uta is a suffix. So when you add this to a word, It designates an unconscious mindset or attitude as controlled perception, reason, and memory, and is now lifted in function from a control set to physical action with decided judgment. So another word or another way to understand when this suffix is added to a word is that we could say this person is now, in regard to that issue, in the desert. An unconscious mindset is controlling everything. So if we go back to page 74, Delgutta, pardon me, my pronunciation isn't all that good, Dagaluta, Dagal, this mendacious, lying, falsifying set, Uta is coming from the unconscious, and it controls perception, reason, memory. This is why some people, it's like there's just no reasoning, there's no breaking through it, because this is, and this is what was, you know, that this came as part of the package when you heard these words in Aramaic. This was just natural. I mean, there's nothing that even reflects this meaning in Aramaic without going to paragraphs of words. But if one's being controlled from that state, then he controls everything in that person's mind. So there are several examples given with variations on the theme of that. Matthew 5:11, deceitfully, 5:33, deceiving, 7:15, deceiving. The kosher, the area swept by the bride's train during the wedding ceremony. So if one's at a wedding ceremony, the train would basically sweep along the floor. And so it would indicate an area, and in Matthew 5:35, it's domain. It speaks of that area that's controlled by that part of the mind. Then moving into being controlled by one's own temptations. Damnasi, Matthew 4:3. Building brain cells. And when we're speaking of one, we're talking about this human being. Speaking of the individual human created essence, or in Aramaic, nafsha. So we have the word nafsha describing the created human being, and we have the word adamos describing the physiological expression. And ultimately, you know, when we're talking about a domain here, we're looking for this mind and this unconscious to be the domain of nafsha, to be controlled by this present love, that when connected with breath, undoes the unconscious dynamics of degeneration. So we're looking to awaken the nafsha. Awakening, you know, when we listen to Yeshua, he says, in order for you to live, you've got to die. That doesn't mean your physical body needs to die. It's saying that your identification with a self based in hostility or fear has to be loosed. You have to be freed from it. And for nafsha, the created essence to take over. And it's not an easy thing to understand if we go to, but what we're looking to do is to make this whole domain that's being spoken of here the domain of conscious awareness from being, from Nafsha, page 84. We'll see, and then what I'd like to do is just read through. Again, we're building brain cells for the mind to be able to support a different perception. So Nafsha, there can be no doubt that the concept to be cued by Nafsha is one of the most fundamental of all Aramaic comprehensions utilized by the prophets. In the Aramaic teachings of Yeshua, he states that all law hangs upon two commandments as follows. And let me make a shift there, because again, this is before we really comprehended the misuse of the word love. So have rachma for the Creator in your entire mind. So people think of the mind, they think of what they're conscious of, but we're not talking about that with the Aramaic. We're talking about the entire mind into the depths of the unconscious, which, you know, I forget what year it was, but Freud was given awards for discovering the unconscious. Or pardon me, let me correct that language, for rediscovering the unconscious, because it's built into the syntax of the Aramaic language. It was so well understood. And yet, in the Western world, there was no such concept. So have rachma for the Creator in your entire mind. In other words, you're going to, in order to keep this so that everything related to the Creator is based in love, you're going to have to clean out your entire mind so that rachma remains the only active filter in the mind. And with your whole nafsha, and in all your actions and in all your thoughts, have rachma for your neighbor as your nafsha. And when we take that one to the next level, then we realize that it is the way to maintain the source of perception as coming through being, coming from the truth of who we are. So the first appearance of nafsha here in these passages in Matthew is usually rendered as soul. The second is rendered as self. The concept soul, while of Greek origin, is a cornerstone in Christian teaching. The concept of self is a cornerstone of psychiatry and psychology. Usually these two words, self and soul, are seen to be somewhat conflicting, yet under the Aramaic language, they are the same word, nafsha. So it is all-inclusive. Clearly, the concept behind nafsha is unknown in the West. Scholars have long sought to unify soul and self without success. If the meaning of nafsha could be ascertained, the unification is obtained. For the word is the source of both soul and self. To assist in defining the concept, it's helpful to review its uses by one who fully understood it. Fortunately, it's used many times by Yeshua in the Gospel of Matthew and was the only gospel first preached and written in Aramaic. So general familiarity with the style used by Yeshua in discourse is helpful in gaining insight into the term he used, as it also is some of the peculiarities of the Aramaic thought patterns throughout his teaching. Yeshua would state a truth well understood by his listeners and then expand from it in logical steps to make his point. With this in mind, several uses of nashir occur, which Yeshua apparently felt would be fully understood by those listening. After healing the leper, Yeshua is reported to have told him, "Go and show your nafsha to the priests." Here he was using nafsha with the assumption it was understood as it was understood by the ordinary person. In this use, it appears to mean the healed appearance of the former leper. And my offering would be that it would be show that nafsha is back as the control mechanism over physiology, and when nafsha is fully in control of physiology of Adamos, there is no disease possible. That was on to say it should be kept in mind that the Aramaic does not usually employ a verbal distinction between a cause and its effect. While nafsha relates to the physical effect here, the clearing of leprosy could literally mean the underlying control of the body which has caused this effect and convey exactly the same understanding. So having nafsha, you know, he's saying go and show your nafsha. There's no distinction between cause and effect. If nafsha, if your created essence is in control of your physiology, you are whole, you are well, you are holy in expression. No disease is possible. And then in Matthew 12:25, Yeshua uses nafsha with the apparent belief, as again it was understood by his listeners, when he states, "For every kingdom you divide against, its nafsha will decay, and every house and city which will be divided against its nafsha will not last." So if our created essence is love, and to me, that word is totally undefinable. But if you hold a newborn child, you can have an experiential definition of the word love. Kind of impossible to put into words, but the words that, you know, of the thousands of people over the years that we've asked to go to their experience of holding a newborn child and describe the essence of the newborn, the words are always things like purity, sweetness, love, harmony, awesome presence. That's usually when Jeannie would ask that question in a workshop over the years, the first place my mind when I would tap in would go would be to the birth of my daughter as she took her first breath and sent me literally into another world. And the only way I could describe it was the awesome presence. That was her nafsha. So when we're divided against that presence of love in us, then what does he say will happen? Decay. And every house and city which shall be divided against its nafsha will not last. With this use, nafsha shows that as the basic control, the fundamental controlling of source of life for a city, a house, or a kingdom. Here the word appears related to a controlling source or cause and not to its effect. The breadth and scope of the controlling cause, the life force of the city, house, or kingdom, designated by nafsha, seems to be total. For to run counter to it is death for that city, house, or kingdom. In Matthew 9:12, it is stated by the writer of the gospel, with the apparent belief that he would be understood, that a woman desiring to be healed of a 12-year flow of blood was saying in her nafsha, "Even if I only touch the fringe of his garment, I shall be healed." And so that's coming from her nafsha, and We're not talking about touching a literal garment. That's a metaphor for stepping into a more powerfully connected nafsh or field of love. And that she knows that she's ready to process out whatever that disease is about. All she needs is that extra bit of oomph, that extra increase in vitality that she will get by touching into Yeshua's energy field. So immediately thereafter, she did exactly what she was saying in her nafsha, indicating the set or goal within her nafsha controlled her behavior. So she moved into the place where she touched into his field and was instantly healed. The Aramaic Gospel of John, which was first stated in the Greek, the concept will is tied to nafshu with these words attributed to Yeshua. I cannot, in the word translate, I cannot from my own selfhood, nafshu, undertake anything. Even while I am hearing, I condemn, and my decision is just, for I do not seek that my will be served, but rather the will of him who sent me. So he's surrendering to guidance here. Clearly, there is in this statement recognition of Nasha as the source of control for judgment and comprehension, but not initiating control. So here the Nasha is going into agreement with guidance. And that guidance would be that which comes from Rukka. And how do we surrender to that? One of the keys is with the breath. Also indicated is the fact that nafsha is subservient and must yield or alter its effect to conform to a person's will, person's goals. So once one has accepted that deeper command, then everything else falls into line. Here's that powerful space in the Course of Miracles that speaks of once you've accepted Rukka's plan, there will be nothing else to be concerned about. For she will go before you, making straight your path and leaving in your way no stones to trip on, no obstacles to bar your way. Nothing you need will be denied you, not one seeming difficulty, but will melt away before you reach it. You need take thought for nothing, careless of everything, except one person that you would, purpose that you would fulfill. And its fulfillment is guaranteed because it rests on you. A son or daughter, the offspring of the Creator. So nafsha here is aligning with a higher will and falling into harmony with that. And from the above uses, we're heading over now to page 86, from the above uses, it is abundantly clear that nafsha at the time of Yeshua was generally understood as the control entity behind the physical, mental, and behaving self. The cause level of mind. With the unification of cause and effect implicit in Aramaic and the unification of control source, for the mental and physical implicit in its uses, nafsha therefore stands for all mental and physical conditions and the control, the source of mental and physical development. This span of meaning lays the basis for its translations in the varied English words as soul, self, itself, and life. And seeing as we're down to the last 10 minutes, I'm going to just open the space so that if there's anything based on what we've covered so far, there's a bit of an opportunity for questions or thoughts. So if you're out there in listener land and you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly. And then if you have a question, all you do is push 1, hand will go up in the control panel. Jeannie will see that hand go up, and she will know that you want to talk to us. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anything happening in the chat room?
No. We have 5 minutes. Come on, somebody press 1.
If you're out there in listener land, is all of this fitting? Is it making sense? Again, we're looking to build brain cells to comprehend what these words in Aramaic, as Yeshua proclaimed them, my words are your perfect life, to come into harmony with, to build the brain cells for a comprehension that just doesn't exist in the English language. And ideas that there's just no verbiage for in Latin, in Greek, or in English. As you can see, and we're only about halfway through the writing on this word nafsha, one word that we thought we understood, and now we see how it ties into control sets, mindsets, unconscious, conscious. I mean, it just ties so much together that doesn't even start to resonate through the use of English words. Is it fitting and making sense, and or does it resonate a question for you if you're out there listening? So we'll just move forward with another paragraph or two, and we'll complete this idea of nafsha tomorrow. So again, this word, it's been translated by a number of English words, and none of them even starting to comprehend what this essay is about. It's been translated by the words soul, self, itself, and life. So also, it may be noted that there is, in the above-quoted uses, the implied suggestion that nafsha may have a quality of performance meaning. With the leper, the instruction to show his nafsha suggests his nafsha might have changed for the better or might have improved its performance. With respect to the nafsha of a city, a house, or a kingdom, an implication of correctness, of truth in addition to controlling power, envelops the meaning of the word. This implication of quality of effect, but mixed with an intrinsic tie to truth, is borne out in other statements. These are instructional statements of Yeshua, apparently intended to inform, to teach, rather than to communicate through the use of a mutually understood term. In Matthew 6:25, the quality of performance, fact of control, and tie to truth elements of nafsha all appear where he gives instructions on making things easier for nafsha. Do not burden your nafsha over what you shall eat, or what you shall drink, or what clothes you shall wear. Is not nafsha greater than nourishment, and your life greater than garments? In line with the thought of Matthew 6:25, he indicates in Matthew 6:33, the results achieved by nafsha varies in conformity with the propriety of an individual's goal or set of will, where in Matthew 6:33 he says, seek first before everything, and we could understand that kingdom of God to be the community of love. So, ultimately, that's where we're heading with everything to do with this series on the Enlightenment book, to reach to eradicating everything that would inhibit one functioning from the presence of love and being restored fully to our human lives as human beings. And so delighted